This is the Pastor Podcast with Randy and Andy. Andy Payton is the lead pastor at Methodist Temple United Methodist Church in Evansville, Indiana. Randy Moore is associate pastor at Methodist Temple. Their goal is to see Christ in everything and everyone.
Welcome in, friends. I'm Randy Moore, along with Andy Payton. We are the pastors of the Randy and Andy Podcast. And Pastor Andy, it is Holy Week, right in the middle of it.
It is upon us, yeah. The highest and holiest week of the Christian year. And I guess it is Wednesday of Holy Week by my calendar. And tomorrow we'll be thinking about Maundy Thursday, and then we'll be thinking about Good Friday, and of course, Easter Sunday. On Facebook last night, someone posted, did you grow up with Maundy Thursday or Holy Thursday? I'm curious, Randy, which one is it for you?
Well, I didn't grow up with either one of them because I grew up in the Baptist tradition. And then when I became a Methodist, and I have been a Methodist longer than I was a Baptist, it was Maundy Thursday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Maundy Thursday.
Yeah. I think it was Maundy Thursday for me too, but I have called it Holy Thursday sometimes, and I'm like, why do I do that?
Right.
You know, what's the distinction? What's the difference between the two?
Well, we'll talk about some of that because we had the discussion, what are we going to talk about this week? Because we're not just dealing with last Sunday and next Sunday. We are dealing with Holy Week. So this is going to be kind of our outline for the next several minutes. We're going to talk in general about Holy Week. Then we're going to talk about Sunday, last Sunday, Palm Sunday. And then we'll talk about Monday because in the book of Mark, Mark separates these two events, Palm Sunday and the Temple Incident. The Temple Incident happens on Monday. So we'll talk about that. We will talk about Maundy Thursday. We'll talk then about Good Friday, and we'll wrap up with a preview of Easter. And so Holy Week. If you look at the Gospel of Mark, and this is the year of Mark in the lectionary, one-third of the Gospel of Mark takes up just that last week, mm-hmm. Holy Week. And then there are those three predictions of Jesus that he's going to have to go to Jerusalem and die. And so everything before that last third is pointing to it. And so here we are. Mark gives it a whole lot of attention, this Holy Week.
Yeah. It's the most important part of the Gospel for Mark, obviously. It's the most important part of the Gospels, just in general. Jesus' last week on earth is where he confronts the powers that be, both politically and religiously, and then exposes their spiritual bankruptcy, really, what happens in this week. But the way I like to think about Holy Week for me, Randy, is, as I kind of mentioned in our podcast last week, Holy Week teaches us how God walked with Jesus through all these events. And what it teaches us also is God walks through with us through all the events of our lives, the seasons of our lives, the ups, the downs, the twists, the turns. Palm Sunday for me represents that moment where the whole world's cheering us on, as I mentioned last week. And then Maundy Thursday is about something's wrong here. When's the next shoe going to drop? Good Friday is, of course, crucifixion. We can't avoid it. It's going to happen. The world is going to break our hearts at some point. And then Easter Sunday is the promise of new life and hope. And so this is the central piece of our faith as Christians. And so we spend the most time on it, as well the gospel writers will spend the most time on it too, because it just is teaching us what is central, what's at the core of the good news of the gospel, and that God is with us, God is loves us, God is for us, these kinds of things.
It's a challenge for pastors, and we've talked about this before. It's a challenge for the church because people are used to, it's programmed into the flow of their week that they're going to be in church on Sunday. It's not in their regular flow through the year that they're going to be in church on Thursday and on Friday, and some churches have, I'm sure, have services all through the week. And so we stress, and it's not just to get more people here for whatever reason. We stress that people take advantage of those services on Thursday and Friday to fully appreciate what goes on during Holy Week. And I always say it's we just miss so much if we leap from Palm Sunday right into Easter. And I think it's a challenge, and it will always be a challenge for the reason I stated. People work. I mean, we're going to do a noon Good Friday service. People work, and so they may not be able to come. Good Friday, that's a Friday night. You're going to have to make a plan that you normally don't have for a Friday night to be there. So it's a difficult thing to handle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the midst of our busy lives, it's the same problem we have all the time, making room for God to enter in, right? Like, you know, of course God can enter into our lives beyond just a service in an evening, but what Holy Week is meant to do is to kind of carve out some time for that to happen. And it's the same challenge we always have, though. We get busy, our calendars get full, our lives get full, and we forget about the deeper dimension, the spiritual dimension of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about Palm Sunday. I had the opportunity to preach on Palm Sunday, and I made the joke at the start of the second service that we gave you the week off so that you could really rest up and bring it on Easter. And you will bring it, but there is that pressure, right?
Yes.
And we can talk about that when we get to Easter, but you're going to have a lot of people, you know, those people that we talk about, the people that are not going to be here on Thursday and Friday, but we can talk about the people who are going to be here on Easter. And pastors can kind of stress themselves out with, okay, I have this audience. What am I going to say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but let's go back to Palm Sunday. I did have the opportunity to preach. And so this is Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. It looks like that it might have been his first time to Jerusalem and that his ministry was 1 year. There is dispute over that. I think that a lot of people might lean toward John, who has a ministry of 3 years. It's just the way Mark structured his gospel. And most of Jesus's ministry is in Galilee, and it isn't until the final week that he goes to Jerusalem. And in other Gospels, especially John, the emphasis is on Judea anyway. So it's a big deal. And as I said, he had been pointing to it. And so I used as my opening illustration the local environmentalist John Blair and the fact that he used a dramatic demonstration to make his point about what we're doing to the environment. Union Carbide in 1985 built a facility to remove PCBs in Henderson County, Kentucky, and John Blair protested that all along the way. It was approved, and when they broke ground, he stole the shovels, mm-hmm. and I showed a picture of Blair being arrested, and I said, I don't tell you about John Blair to elevate him to the level of Jesus Christ, but to help me explain what it was that Jesus was up to when he went up to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And when you really take a look at this and the history behind it, you can really see that it was absolutely a demonstration. It was in dramatic action. Mm-hmm. When words won't do, it's action. And about half of the account of Palm Sunday is occupied with arranging for transportation.
For the colt, the donkey, right?
Right. So we can see that he's preparing this demonstration. So Pontius Pilate, we know this from the history, that Pontius Pilate at Passover would enter Jerusalem because he didn't live there. He would enter Jerusalem from the west. And we see Jesus entering from the east. Pontius Pilate enters on a horse. And here's the demonstration. Jesus enters on a colt.
Mm-hmm.
Pontius Pilate comes with the threat of violence. Keeping the peace with the threat of violence, Jesus comes in peace.
Mm-hmm.
Just a beautiful, beautiful message, I think.
It's rich.
Yeah.
In so many ways, in so many levels, what's happening when Jesus does this on Palm Sunday, he's, as you talked about in your sermon, he's enacting a tradition from the Hebrew prophets in which they protested in various ways. The powers that be of their time, and here comes Jesus protesting the powers that be of his time in the ways that he does. And in some ways, I think he's enacting what Zechariah's prophecy kind of gets tucked into this some ways, because Zechariah the prophet talked about a donkey, the king, the new Messiah coming on a donkey or a colt and these kinds of things. But yeah, it's I preached a sermon on Palm Sunday once. I called it impasse. It's an impasse. There's two very different worldviews. There's two very different ways of understanding how peace is brought about. And of course, they have a collision, and Holy Week is the collision between these two powers. And as Christians, we believe the good news is the gospel is, of course, God's love overcomes the powers of be, the pilots of the time. And And we as Christians should wrestle with how that should apply to us today. Because, well, it's hard to take this in and think about, well, what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a part of a church? And how much should we coddle up to the way of the world versus the way of the kingdom of God? And so I'll let the listeners deal with that part. But that's something I struggle with as a pastor, because when I've preached on these texts like this over the years, you worry that you're going to be ridiculed or criticized, because people will say, you're being political here. And no, I'm not. Yes, I am, because Jesus is too. You know,
right.
I'm not trying to be political. I'm just trying to be faithful to what is actually happening in the text and actually happening in the gospel and talking about what it means for our lives. People want to take the Bible seriously. Let's take the Bible seriously. Mm-hmm. This is what Jesus was about. This is what he was doing. He was confronting what he believed was an injustice of his time in the way that he had a parade arranged beforehand. And that's why I think Mark's gospel takes so much time talking about the cult, because it's pre-planned.
Right.
You know, this is not like Jesus woke up on a Tuesday and said, hey, you know, we're going to go down to Jerusalem and have a parade. No, this is Jesus thinking very seriously, praying about it, thinking about how do I enact God's kingdom for my time today.
The other thing that argues for the pre-planning is that Jesus didn't need a ride into Jerusalem.
Right.
He walked everywhere. He could have walked on in. And so the fact that he even got up on an animal lets you know what's going
right.
on here.
Yeah.
And that fact that they took so much time. I said in the message that John Blair might not have been thinking about this, but he was doing something that was in line with the Hebrew prophets, and I said that there are three categories, three broad categories that we can take a look at and see what the prophets did. And the prophets communicated by what they saw. They were visionaries. Mm-hmm. What they saw going on in front of them, by what they say. Some of the prophets wrote. Other prophets had their oracles written down for them, and by what the prophets do. And that's the thing that I wanted to zero in on in this message, because John Blair did something. He, in dramatic action, he did something. It got attention. It didn't prevent the plant from opening, but it got attention. And I mentioned, and I'll just mention these briefly, I took kind of a humorous approach on this because I found humor in these prophets. But the three major prophets, of course, are Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And Isaiah, one time, to dramatically illustrate the fact that we can either trust in God or trust in foreign alliances. And if we trust in foreign alliances other than God, we might end up seeing ourselves carried off into exile with our behinds showing, because Isaiah demonstrated this by, for 3 years, this is Isaiah of Jerusalem, by for 3 years walking around Jerusalem naked and barefoot. And I noted that it seemed like it might have been overkill to say naked and barefoot, that naked should just cover it. But a little deeper dive, I found that the word that's translated naked, it likely means exposed buttocks.
Okay.
So he walked around with his buttocks exposed, and barefooted, and
which
so,
I would think in that culture bring shame on the people who saw him.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's exposing their shame.
Yes.
Jesus teaches something very similar in the Sermon on the Mount, actually.
Yeah.
Whenever it says in the Sermon on the Mount where if Jesus says, what is it? How's it go? If someone asks you for your coat,
yes,
give it to them.
Yeah.
And if they ask you for more, give it to them. And so in the Jesus's time, you typically wore two coats, if you will. There was like the outer robe, there's an inner robe. And basically Jesus says, give it all to them. And then they'll expose their shame, because you'll be standing there nude in front of them. And in those days, that was shameful to see that. And so I feel like that's what Isaiah in some ways is doing too for the people. Like, look, shame on you
right.
for living this way, and shame on you for trampling on people. And that's what I see the prophets doing. And I feel like that's what Jesus is kind of doing too. Shame on you for, I don't know, for being hoodwinked
right.
by the powers that be.
Yeah. Dramatic prophetic action. Jeremiah, he heard the Lord say to him, take your loincloth and go out and bury it in the cleft of a rock, leave it there, send him back to get it, pulls it out. The condition of that loincloth, pretty awful, worthless, the scripture says, as in dramatic action, demonstrating that if we don't trust God, that we could end up being worthless. There's a story, a whole story behind that, which is too complicated to get into. But the point is that Jeremiah used this dramatic action to tell the people, trust in God, trust in God. And if not, you know, what you're doing may end up being as worthless as this old pair of underwear. And then finally, Ezekiel, in his call, was actually, and this was in a vision, but he was actually asked to eat a scroll, dramatically demonstrating that from now on, what he says, the words that come out of his mouth, having eaten the scroll, are God's words.
That's a powerful image there, because it's suggesting that we're supposed to digest the words of God and allow them to become a part of us. It's much more, you can't just hear it. It's got to become a part of you. That's when I hear that with Ezekiel, like, that's kind of weird at first. I'm like, that's odd.
Right.
But then once you think about the deeper meaning here, it's saying, hey, you can't just read the book. You can't just talk about the commands. We can't just give love lip service here. It's got to become a part of us and a part of our bodies, a part of our way of life, and a part of the fabric of who we are. This is what they're getting at.
It's a vivid way of getting that message across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very communion-like, by the way. I mean,
that too.
Not to foreshadow Maundy Thursday, but that's kind of what's happening there.
Right.
Lord Jesus, I'm going to take your body. I'm going to drink from this cup. Become a part of me. I want you to become a part of my body.
I'm stealing that, by the way. I'm making a note and I'm stealing that idea.
Okay. I'm sure I just stole it from someone else.
That's really good.
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's the foundational way as we as Christians pray. In fact, one of the most meaningful times in which I served communion was at a wedding, happened offsite, and it was a very diverse group of people. Mm-hmm. There was folks that clearly were not Christian from the Muslim background, and it was just a very diverse situation, and the couple wanted me to serve Holy Communion. And so I thought to myself, how will I present this in a way that won't be offensive to people? Because I don't want to come across like this is an exclusive table. One of the things we really believe as Methodists is this is an open table. Anyone can come. And so when I stood up there, and when it came time in the service for the ceremony for the Holy Communion to be served, I said to the folks, I go, look, this is the most foundational way we as Christians pray. By standing up and coming forward and eating and then drinking, essentially what you're saying is, Lord Jesus, I want you to be a part of my life. I want to live your way of life, become a part of me. And anyone who's interested in that is welcome at this table. I believe that brings honor to Jesus. I think he would be completely okay with that, which is one of the problems I have with certain traditions in Christendom that say, well, you have to be baptized like us. You have to do this or that before you go to the table. No, you just have an open heart. Say, hey, yeah, I'm interested in this. I want it to become part of my life.
Yeah, the open table. So good. So good. So I brought up the fact that most of us who've been in the church very long would have heard that about the offices of Jesus. You know, Jesus as king, priest, and prophet. And he probably fits the bill. I mean, he fits the bill, of course, in some aspect in all three of those. But it's as prophet that he's operating here, as prophet. And so just as Ezekiel ate that scroll and Jeremiah unearthed the dirty underwear and Isaiah walked around with his buttock showing, and John Blair stole the golden groundbreaking shovels, Jesus staged that double demonstration to protest the violence of Roman imperial power. And secondly, the religious collaboration with that power. It was that collusion between the Roman governor Pilate and the Jewish high priest Caiaphas. And in each of those events, they have these things in common. They have a piece of dramatic action, and then they have that prophetic citation from one of the Old Testament prophets. And the first demonstration happens in the entry to Jerusalem, as we said, on what we call Palm Sunday. The setting is Jerusalem at Passover at the beginning of the last week of Jesus' life, the week that we call Holy Week. And I've already said this, Jesus came in from the west, and Pilate came in from the west, Jesus from the east, Pilate on a horse, Jesus on a donkey. And you brought this up. That comes from Zechariah. Rejoice greatly, O daughter Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, triumphant and victorious is he, humble and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. This is messianic, but Jesus doesn't come with violence, not to overthrow through violence, mm-hmm. but he comes in peace. The Messiah comes in peace. And so they see this in the Hebrew scriptures, and Jesus enacts, fulfills.
Well, and even the waving of the palm branches, I've learned, and I didn't have time to look this up, but I remember is that connects to Maccabees.
Yeah.
Where Maccabees is an extra canonical book of the Bible. It's not in the Protestant Bible. It's in the Catholic Bible. But what happens there is the folks, they rise up against their captors at that time and they're defeated, and the Jewish people wave palm branches as a sign of that victory. And so just waving a little palm branch around, you know, to us today is like, well, that's peaceful. And
right.
And yes, it is. It's not a sword.
Right.
But it's a sign of victory.
Yeah.
Our King, our Messiah brings victory. And so this is treasonous stuff in the first century context. It's important we use that word, because the Romans, they would have taken this very seriously.
They were watching.
Yes. And you talk about this in the sermon. They waited until he didn't have the crowds around him when they arrest him.
Mm-hmm.
They waited.
Yeah.
Because if they would have arrested him when there was a big crowd, of course, that would have led to an uprising of the people. And that's the exact goal that they're not, you know, they're trying to avoid that. That's the goal, is peace for the Romans.
And right.
But here you have this guy enacting these prophecies. The people are waving their palm branches. This is a charged environment. The closest thing I think we've experienced to this, maybe it's a civil rights movement where they're marching in the streets of Birmingham and different places like that with Martin Luther King and folks like that. And it's a charged environment. And yes, they're peaceful, but it's going to there's going to be, conflict right. on the horizon here.
He knew, Jesus had to know that it could have gotten him killed.
Yes.
He had to know. And we've talked about this before. Did he go intending to get killed? And we can talk about that. But what we can say for sure is he certainly knew what he was doing could have gotten him killed. So this first demonstration is a protest against the Roman imperial power, and the second demonstration is a protest against the religious collaboration with that Roman power. And I said, in order to catch that, though, we have to move past the text that we were dealing with, the mm-hmm. Palm Sunday text, and go a few verses forward, because Mark separates these two events. The other gospel writers keep them on the same day. Mark has the Sunday has the entry. Monday has the temple event. And it's in the temple event where Jesus overturns the money changers. We call that, you know, cleansing the temple. But he didn't really cleanse the temple, because the temple kept on going. I mean, it was a demonstration. Mm-hmm. It was a demonstration. And so again, there was a prophetic citation. Jesus says, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." That comes right out of Jeremiah. And so it was not so much the money changing, because the money changing had to happen. It was the fact that that the temple was in collaboration with the Romans. The high priest was appointed mm-hmm. by the Romans, and this is what Jesus is demonstrating against there.
And so, according to Jesus, the issue is not that we're selling baked goods in the narthex at the church. The issue is that they're collaborating with one another. That the religious institution is not serving its purpose any longer. It's not holding the powers that be in check any longer. They're working together. And this is, you know, this is not an isolated incident. This has happened again and again throughout history. When religion is hijacked for political ends, it loses its power. Or to say it even a different way, it becomes something that's far more dangerous, because people think, oh, God is on our side, therefore we're righteous in doing whatever it is we're getting ready to do. And so, boy, I don't know. I think this is the moment where you need to take a pause here and just say, and in the United States today, let us be very careful with nationalism and these kinds of things when they get blended in with Christianity, because Christianity is a universal good news for all people, not just our people. And so as religious people, we have to be very careful in terms of fulfilling our mission of being the conscience.
I love this from Jeremiah. Jeremiah says, "Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord. This is the temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord." Three times. Three times means something. Don't say this temple is going to save you if when you're outside the temple, you're oppressing the poor. You're not loving the neighbor. Justice, the message of justice right there to say, you know, don't think the temple's going to save you. And he actually, and he tells Jeremiah, or Jeremiah through this prophecy says, I'll destroy the temple. If that's the way you're going to treat the temple, you think it's going to save you. It's all about what I'm calling you to do, which is to come in peace and not violence, to work for justice and to love your neighbor. The widows and the orphans and that whole thing. And of course, and I made the connection that, you know, our church is wonderful. Our worship is wonderful. What we do here is very, very important. How we form as the body of Christ right here is wonderful. But that's not the be all and end all. It's following the commands of Jesus to go, to go out there and to do all those things that Jeremiah talked about.
Well, Jesus' short phrase for what he was getting at was, the kingdom of God is at hand.
Yeah.
Let's dream about this world as if God were king and live our lives accordingly. Under that basic mission comes Palm Sunday and the cleansing of the temple and all these other things that he's doing. He's saying, hey, let's dream about this world in a different way where Caesar's not emperor any longer, where we're actually living according to God's way. And the religious institutions is a place. The religious institutions are a place where this idea of justice is lifted up, and the poor are lifted up, and these kinds of things. This is Jesus' message. There's no denying it.
Mm-hmm. And I noted it for the first time, really on my part, that I was proud of the United Methodist Church, because in all likelihood, when the United Methodist Church meets in General Conference next month, the church will finally eliminate that harmful language that's in our discipline about our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. And I wanted to mention it because I never really had an opportunity in front of our congregation to stand beside you in support of that. I mean, I think people know that my position on it is in agreement with yours, but I had never made a public statement of it. And so I wanted to do that. And I did, I do think it fits what we're talking about in seeking justice, because it is a justice issue, because that language, it has hurt real people. And I tried to make this point emphatically, the language that's been in our discipline hasn't hurt theoretical people or this sort of unfocused group of people. It has hurt real people. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the takeaways that I wanted to leave with our people. And then I ask a couple of questions. Why didn't Jesus get killed on Sunday or Monday? And you've already mentioned it. It was because he was protected by the crowds, and this leads us deeper into the Holy Week. But he had the protection of the crowds in Jerusalem during the daytime. But if you'll notice, he keeps going back to Bethany at night, where there's protection there. And then maybe we'll talk about this more when we get to Monday, Thursday. But it's finally on Thursday where Judas sees the opening that, hey guys, I can help you get to him as he moves from Bethany back to Jerusalem in nighttime when he doesn't have the protection of the big crowds. And so, and then at the trial, and we'll mention this too when we get to Good Friday, Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. And I made the point that we have tended to say, that's like Jesus saying, you take care of heaven, Pilate, or the earth, Pilate, and I'll take care of heaven. But that's not really what he meant. He meant that, Pilate, your world is one of violence, and my worldview is one of, and what I bring is peace, not violence. And there's where I made my appeal about the importance of Monday, Thursday, and Good Friday. And you know what is going to help? Virtual worship is going to help, right? I don't know what we're doing on Thursday.
Are we streaming it.
Okay, yeah. So there's another way people can do it. If their schedules don't allow for it, there's another way that people can take part in those because they are so important. And I just closed my message on Sunday saying, do you think that John Blair's dramatic demonstration was effective? The plan opened up. And do you think Jesus' demonstration was effective? And I think the answer to both is yes. Yeah. I think most definitely.
They accomplished their mission in the sense that they exposed what they were trying to expose.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So we've covered Sunday and Monday. Tuesday and Wednesday, those can be interesting, but we know that he was in dialogue in the temple there. But then the next big day is Monday, Thursday.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the night of the Last Supper. In John's gospel, we get a little more dialogue in terms of what happens that night because Jesus also washes the feet of the disciples. And there's this wonderful interchange between Jesus and his disciples, particularly Peter, when Jesus is washing his feet. He's like, oh, no, no, you know. And so, but it's this act of humility and servanthood and love. And so, but the big moment is when he predicts that someone's going to betray him and then also offers bread to each and every one of them, including Judas. And in this moment, what we discover is really the Christian ethic of what we mean by the word love. Love is offered to even the one who's going to betray us. We're going to believe in that person too, in a sense. And that's a real challenge for us. What's the measure of one's holiness? What's the measure of one's faith and faithfulness? It's, well, how do you treat the enemy? Do you offer them bread or not? And I don't know. That's one that every year I chew on that a little bit. Like, boy, I don't know. And you wonder what Judas's motivations really were, too. That's one of the questions that scholars have debated for quite some time. It's kind of, maybe he's a zealot, right? And,
yeah.
And zealots were more violent. They wanted to violently protest the Romans and overthrow the Romans in an act of violence. And so maybe
he's just spurring Jesus to action.
Yeah, he's trying to, like, okay, let's get going here. I'm ready for this to happen. And so Judas's vision of what Jesus was supposed to do is not what Jesus's vision of what Jesus was supposed to do really was. And so there was some conflict there, maybe. Yeah. I think Judas thinks he's doing the right thing in a sense, maybe. I don't know. These are things that are hard to wrestle with. Judas gets a bad name in the life of Christendom and tradition too, because he's the one that he's the sellout, right? He tells on Jesus, but
and John is particularly hard on Judas,
mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's a subject for lifelong prayer and study, mm-hmm. Isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But even think about the bigger picture here. God uses what Judas does for good in the end. Even the worst things become the best things whenever they're understood through the lens of grace. It's not what he didn't. I'm not saying what Judas did was right, but what I'm suggesting is God's love is even bigger than the greatest of failures. And that's such an important message to get because we've been raised to believe, much of us, maybe all of us in a sense, we've been raised to believe that love is conditioned upon our performance. And that's not this news. That's not this good news that Jesus is offering at the table this night. He says, hey, I want you to love one another. He even offers it to the guy. I know what you're getting ready to go do. Love you anyway. And wow.
That's powerful.
It is. It's so powerful.
Yeah.
It's the message that, well, it's so holy, we have to tell that story every single year.
Mm-hmm.
Because every single year, we have someone that's probably betrayed us at some point, that's hurt us, that did not love us well. And the question that it's begging us to ask ourselves is, okay, so you say you want to be a follower of Jesus Christ. This is what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. This is what it means to call oneself a disciple. And the word disciple, of course, means discipline. You're going to discipline yourself. And yeah, now we're going to discipline ourselves because it's hard to love our enemy. And I think it's important now to talk about what do we mean by love. It's not this warm and fluffy thing. It's more like Jesus continues to believe in Judas's potential to get it right anyway. He's going to make a mistake here, but I think Jesus continued to believe in Judas's potential to get it right. And I feel like that's what it means for us to love one another too. It's not like we're going to like everybody.
Right.
But I'm still going to believe in a person's potential to enact Christ-like love. I believe that's who at the core we are, each and every one of us truly are as children of God.
That message is too good to miss. Thursday night, 7 p.m., Methodist Temple.
And I'm not preaching.
Right.
Ryan Buxton is preaching.
Our youth director, Ryan
Buxton.
First
sermon out.
Yeah. Yes.
He has got a good sermon, too. I've read it.
Oh, have you?
I read
okay.
it. Yes, he's.
Oh, you had to have approval? I'm just kidding.
No, he wanted me to offer any suggestions. And I'll say that's much better than the first sermon I ever preached.
Oh, and mine too, I'm sure. Ryan is meticulous.
Yes.
He isn't. It'll be really good.
It'll be worth it.
Yeah, I'm going to try to get over here. I've been talking about how important it is to be here, but I'm in that group too. I work in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to try to slip over here, you know, for it at 7 o'clock between newscasts. So really looking forward to it. So Ryan is preaching, and as you mentioned, it's about Holy Communion. Thursday's about Holy Communion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that's when he had that meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the commandment to love.
Yeah.
And they're tied together.
Yeah.
As we were talking about earlier, this idea of obedience and faithfulness, it's tied into Holy Communion. I remember Bishop Coyner saying that maybe one way to think about it would be our baptism represents justifying grace, and then communion is a lot about sanctifying grace. So what's mm-hmm. those words mean? Well, justifying, God loves me just as I am. Nothing can ever stop that. But in communion, it's more like sanctifying grace. Give me the grace now to live as if I, you know, to become what I already am.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm a child of God. I'm the beloved of God. Now, in this act of communion, I'm asking God, give me the strength, give me the grace to become what I already am, you already call me this, so let me become that. And that's all there. I'm geeking out a little
that's
bit.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
no,
okay.
Yeah, no, it's rich, and there's so many angles we can take.
But. So on Thursday night of Holy Week, Thursday night of the last week in Jesus' earthly life, Judas goes out to do what he has to do, and that is to betray Jesus to the authorities. And so on Good Friday, Jesus goes to the cross on Good Friday. And I will be speaking at the Methodist Temple Good Friday service here at Methodist Temple at noon, and then we will join other United Methodist congregations at Aldersgate Friday evening at 7. And I don't want to give away what I'm going to say, but I will say that I'm going to focus on Psalm 22. It is one of the Psalms of Lament, and the church in general does not like Psalms of Lament. You can open the hymnal, and we don't sing a lot of songs of lament, even though about 30% of the Psalms are Psalms of Lament. But this is the one that the church cannot avoid because it opens with the words, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And of course, these are words that come off of the lips of Jesus on the cross in Mark and in Matthew? I'd have to look. Anyway, in the Gospel of Mark, I don't think it is. We can look it up.
Well, Matthew's similar. Luke, definitely not. Luke presents Jesus as much more confident. You know, he's like, in Luke's account, Jesus, of course, prays on the cross, "Forgive them, Father, they don't know what they're doing." And then as Jesus dies in Luke's account, he says, "Into your hands, O Lord, I commend my spirit." And so there's this real confidence to Jesus as he dies in Luke's account. And I think John's pretty similar in the sense that Jesus is very confident in that. I don't know about Matthew.
Matthew
though.
Says it. I don't know why it's questioned.
Yeah, my God,
it is.
My God, why you've forsaken me? Yeah.
Yeah. So again, that comes from Psalm 22, and what's interesting about it is if you look at Psalm 22, and you look at the way it's described, it mentions a tune, and nobody knows what that tune is, but this leads us to believe that the Hebrews actually sang this song.
Mm-hmm.
They sang this song, and it is dire. I mean, the first half of this is dire. It describes how the psalmist is dying, mm-hmm. literally dying. and they sing it. And this gives us permission to not deny the reality of life and the sufferings that come from life, and to take those to God. And the psalmist is crying, God, where are you? Mm. Where are you? We don't dare pray a prayer like that. But the Psalms tell us to pray like that, to
Jesus
pray
did
like
too.
That. Yes, and Jesus did too. So again, I don't want to give away the whole thing, but there is a turn in Psalm 22. Mm. There is a dramatic pivot where it goes from complaint and plea to praise. And so we can see Psalm 22 as the model of life, and the model of Jesus's life, crucifixion and resurrection. So that's going to be my meditation on Good Friday. 3 hours of darkness when Jesus died.
So you're going to preach for 3 hours?
3 hours of, well, you know what? Some, I picked this up, I didn't know this until this time. Some traditions, they worship for three hours on Good Friday because of the 3 hours of darkness.
We might get a complaint.
3 hours of darkness. And it made me think about, for the first time, the eclipse. That's going to be a couple of minutes of darkness.
Yes.
There's a moment, there's a teaching moment in there somewhere about the darkness that we're going to experience in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. Pastor Jerry was telling me that when an eclipse happens and you're in the woods, all the animals start coming out.
Right.
In darkness mode, in night mode. So the birds will stop singing and the animals will begin to shift over to, they just automatically do that.
Right.
So interesting how connected everything really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But Psalm 22, not the most uplifting song you'll ever sing.
No.
No, it's not. It's real, though.
It's in our Psalter.
Yeah, it's real.
Yeah.
And I think we might be singing a little bit in our Good Friday service. I'll have to look. I'm pretty sure it's in there. But we just do a refrain in there. So we're not going to try to chant the whole thing. But if you would go to some of the more liturgical churches, they will sometimes chant a full song, full psalm like that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's different.
Yeah. Yeah.
For those of us who grew up Protestant, we don't typically do those kinds of things, but there's some wisdom in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I could go on and I want to go on, but I'm not going to.
I know
to.
I can see. I can just tell that you just have, you want to chit chat it up about Good Friday, Randy.
I don't want to give it all away before Friday. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and you don't want to give Easter away either, and you're still working on your sermon too, but tell us what you're thinking and praying about.
Easter's number 4 on my holiday list as a kid. Number 1 was Christmas because I got presents. Number 2 was Thanksgiving because it often coincided with my birthday, and so therefore I could get presents. And then I think the 3rd was 4th of July. There was no presents, but there was firecrackers, and that was fun.
Yeah.
And then there was Easter.
Yeah.
And so it was number 4 on my list as a child. But as Christians, Easter is meant to be number 1. And why? Because without Easter, we would have never heard about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been forgotten.
Right.
And so I'm going to try to do what I always do on Easter, is talk about, so why does this matter for my life today? The story about this Jesus that dies and rises again. What's the implication? What's the so that for my life today? Mm-hmm. And it's the hardest sermon I preach every year. It's so hopeful. It's so celebratory. It's the gospel, but yet it's the most difficult because everyone leans in and they think they already know the story, and in a sense, they do. So how do we help people we want to inspire people to not just say Easter, but to practice it in our lives. And what does that look like? What's that mean? That's what I'm wrestling with. How do we go from number 4 on the list to number 1, you know?
And that's what Mark asks us to do. Of course, the Gospel of Mark has that that ending where the women flee from the tomb in fear, and we don't have resurrection appearances in the Gospel of Mark. The church and tradition added some endings later, but I think most people believe that it ended. Mark's gospel ended. The dog didn't eat that half of the scroll. That it actually did end with the women fleeing, and so now it's on us. What are we gonna do with the empty tomb?
Mm-hmm. Another angle to that. This is why we do the podcast, I guess.
Right.
But okay, they don't tell anyone. Right? It says they don't tell anyone. They're afraid. Right. Jesus catches them anyway.
Right.
I think that's probably what happens.
Yeah.
Which is the idea of grace.
Yeah.
That we're saved by grace. And that word saved has some baggage. Another way to think about saved is I'm made whole by grace. I become my full self when I become aware of grace. So what does grace say? God comes and finds you, goes looking for you.
Yeah.
Even when you're afraid, you won't tell anyone.
Yeah.
And I think that's the real pivot for Christianity, is we have a lot of religious traditions that say, do this, don't do that. What we have here in the gospel, though, is a God that goes looking for us, chasing us down, still loves us, still believes in us. I mean, that's the news we all need to hear.
And we'll hear it Sunday.
Well, we'll hope.
Yeah. So. Yeah. We hope that we have given you enough information about Holy Week, but not given you so much that you're not compelled to come and experience it with us, or to experience it wherever you're going to experience it.
Sure.
But, give yourself permission to prioritize this week and give it some attention this week. And we thank you so much for listening to our podcast. And you're invited to come and join us here in person anytime. You can worship with us virtually as well. But we trust and we pray that you'll have a blessed Holy Week and a really, really good celebration of Easter. Talk to you next week.
This has been the Pastor Podcast with Randy and Andy. You are welcome to join us at Methodist Temple in person or online. Methodist Temple is at 2109 Lincoln Avenue in Evansville, Indiana. Our traditional Sunday morning worship service is at 8:30 with our contemporary service at 11. Log on to our website at methodisttemple.church. We see Christ in you.